Welcome to Red Alert Radio, grassroots radio with an ear on the issues that matter to you. Hosted by your local Labour MPs.
Kia ora koutou katoa, ngā mihi nui, kia koutou. Welcome to yet another episode of Red Alert Radio. My name is Priyanka Radhakrishnan and I'm the Labour List MP based in the Maungakeakea electorate. On today's show, we've got someone who's incredibly interesting in terms of the work that she's doing and the way she expresses it. We've got with us in the studio today Kashil Charan, who is an artist of Indo-Fijian heritage who lives and works in Aotearoa. She uses traditional modes of textile making to reflect on the impact of indentured labour on the Indo-Fijian community and the ongoing effects of neocolonialism. By utilising traditional methods, including wood-carved flora and fauna that's stamped onto naturally dyed cotton, Kashil recaptures and restores her community's ownership of Indo-Fijian history. Her work is also a form of visually expressed oral storytelling and is also an acknowledgement of the Gurmitias, the ancestors of indentured labourers who were taken to Fiji. Kashil, a very warm welcome to you and thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So I first met you at an exhibition that you did out west, possibly a few months back, where you displayed some of your artwork and talked about the research that's gone on behind the scenes as well. Can you tell me how you initially came to be working with textiles and embroidery?
I've always grown up around textile making and traditional craft, especially through my father's side, through my aji, so my paternal grandmother. I made the decision in my last year of high school to go to Elam School of Fine Arts, and there I was introduced to a more Western framework of what contemporary art was, something that I really hadn't engaged with before. I struggled in that first year, and I found like I couldn't communicate through the Western art forms that they were introducing me to, so I made a natural transition to go back to textile making. I felt like at the time, and I still do as well, that's where I have a voice. It's a way for me to communicate my ideas more freely. So that's how it began. It was kind of a pushback against what Western art was.
Yeah. And trying to fit you into a bit of a box in the scenes.
Yeah, definitely. I found that if I couldn't understand these art forms, how could I make art that I wanted my own community to understand? Mm. And I feel that traditional craft and traditional art from non-Western communities have the capacity to exist in contemporary art quite freely. Mm. So it was about, you know, bringing that back. And also I think it's a very it's very connected to colonialism as well, that traditional craft is kind of put in its own box. Mm. So I was like, no, actually I can push those boundaries. Our forms of craft can exist as well within what contemporary art is, and we are inherently connected to these things as well. We can make these kind of art forms exist in galleries too.
Mm, beautiful. Tell me a little bit now about the role that your aji plays in your work.
So my aji, she's kind of everything, I guess. Mm. With my aji, it started off with, so I went off and started making the textiles. It must have been my second year in university. And then I went back home to Ngāwe Vumba, and I remember showing aji the textiles, and there was this like big surprise in her face being like, oh, you want to engage with textiles. That's really interesting, because I think, you know, for us back home in Fiji, we, because of corporate tourism, craft is kind of isolated within the tourist market or the craft markets. So she'd never seen something like textiles being put in a gallery as such. So she was quite surprised that that's the work that I wanted to engage with, and she was very happy. So it started to introduce broader conversations around textile making. And the first thing she did once I showed her these textiles, I dyed them with haldi, with turmeric, and I'd done some woodblock prints of flora that you'd find in Fiji. and talking about the environment and the landscape and, you know, missing home and missing her. So that was kind of like the first lot of textiles that I was making. She went to, she's got like a little archive in her room underneath her office desk, and it's all of her pictures and files from her days in the Women's Council, and she did that for most of her life. So the Women's Council runs most of the craft markets and the handicraft. So the Women's Expo is one of our biggest events for craft in Fiji. So she was a part of all of that. And she showed me all these different art forms she'd been making and all these things she'd done with her hands. And I was like, this is amazing. You know, I'm a part of this history as well. This is something I want to explore more. So by having that introduction from her and inviting me into these memories, that's what really pushed me to keep going with textile making.
Mm. Mm. Why is it so important for you to sort of, I guess, be aware of that history and where you come from?
I think being Indo-Fijian, inherently, like, this is really important for us to understand these histories. Like, indentured labour was abolished in 1920. So the last ship, if I've got this right, came in 1917, and then the whole entire system finished in 1920. That wasn't that long ago. Mm. You know, it's a very short time ago, and we're still dealing with the ramifications of that type of a colonisation and that trauma. And to deny, well, not to deny, but through colonialism, the biggest part was to deny us to our histories. Mm. So they wrote us out of what a Western history was. So we didn't really exist in history books, and especially so the female grumitias, they were completely taken out of the indentured labour history. So to reclaim those histories is an anti-colonial tactic as well. And I think being Indo-Fijian, even though indentured labour brought about a lot of trauma and violence, that's where we really found our resilience as well. As a community, we pushed back against the colonizer and we built ourselves up, and we don't get to be Indo-Fijian today without that history.
Mm.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the role of women grumitias, mm-hmm. and what you've discovered through your research.
Okay, definitely. So apart from my textile making, I do a lot of archival research. The reason this came about was I knew the kind of more broader indentured labour history, but there were little things missing, and one of the biggest things was no matter what, even if I, you know, no matter how many Indo-Fijian academic texts I came to, there was never really a mention of grumitias women.
Mm.
And even with family, if you tried to talk about the subject, there's a lot of shame and there's a lot of silence. And I think that's probably the best way to describe myself growing up Indo-Fijian and trying to understand indentured labour, is that you're kind of living around silence.
Mm.
And Aji would say little snippets of things. Oh, the woman, you know, it was very hard for them. You know, one woman had to house four men. But that was kind of the end of the conversation. And so you're just left with this understanding that there was great oppression towards the grumitias woman, but not knowing the kind of full effect of what was going on in the system. I came to a text by Vijay Naidu. It's his first text that he wrote, and in it he interviewed some grumitias across Fiji, and out of it there were like three female respondents. The rest of them were men, and the one thing that kept popping up was the saying, you know, our women, they change their men like they change their lingas, their skirts. And that really pissed me off. I was like, how could you say this? So I had to understand why that was being said. And so basically, if we look at the history of indentured labour, it came after the abolishment of slavery in the Americas. And so there was an issue for the empire. How was it going to make its money in the colonies? So they looked at a system of bonded labour as such. So you entered set tasks in a contract, and the idea was that you'd get paid at the end of that contract or at the end of those set tasks. So they targeted indentured labour predominantly to Indian and Chinese mm-hmm. populations. And so with indenture, when it first came about, there were discussions around who can be brought to the colonies, and obviously...
So that's just when it was being discussed in general, not specific to Fiji?
Not specific to Fiji, so right. The whole system of indenture. They only wanted men to come to the colonies. They did not see women as a viable... they didn't see them as viable labourers. And so... they sent the men off, and then there became a problem. But who are the men meant to engage with sexually, and who's going to hold down the household? So eventually...
So they discovered then that actually women played a huge role in life more generally.
But it was a very, a gendered and a very colonial perception as well. And it was, it was empire's perception of those gender roles too enforced onto these communities, which is a huge issue. And so what happened was... they decided we're going to bring women into indenture, but only as the counterpart to the male, as the domestic and sexual counterpart to the male labourers. And so with Fiji, what came about was the Indian colonial government at the time didn't want to send women to the colonies, and especially so to Fiji. So there was an argument about gender ratios. And what happens with Fiji is that we have roughly one woman to every four men.
Right.
Yeah, and you can only imagine what happens when you kind of create an environment like that. So when they come to Fiji, they don't, one, obviously because of language barriers, and there was definitely a lot of trickery happening at the time. They didn't fully understand what they were walking into. There are oral accounts from other Indo-Fijian academics who have done, much more extensive research, that they didn't actually know that they'd be going to a place that's, a whole boat ride about 2 to 3 months away from India. Some people thought they were going to other parts of India for labour and they could easily return home, because it was a five-year contract. So you had a five-year contract, then you could return on your own accord. If you went for another 5 years, so in total 10 years, then the idea was that the colonial government would send you back to India. So ideally, when you're given this contract, it sounds quite great, and especially while you're under colonisation under the British Raj, there was a lot of transitions in India, and especially the areas that my ancestors were coming from. Their traditional markets were being completely crashed. There was no viable outcomes for income at the time, so they had to move.
Mm.
So they get to Fiji, and... their reality is shattered by the violence that comes with indentured labour and the hard labour. So the set tasks that were given to them were physically impossible to complete. So men had more set tasks than women, but men...
What were some of the examples of those tasks?
So they had a thing, so they measured, their measuring unit was chains. So if I remember correctly, it was you'd get X amount of chains each day, and you'd have to plough the land, and then you'd have to get it ready for planting and then cutting, and then there's also harvest. So you have to cut the cane and then burn all the cane, and then you've got to go through that process again of replowing the land and planting all over again.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the main kind of tasks, and there were other kinds of plantation work in Fiji happening, but my main area of research is into sugarcane.
Right.
Yeah.
And some of the set tasks for women?
It was the same to the men, but what the difference was that their set tasks weren't to the same level, and then they were paid a lot less than the men. And for both men and women, these tasks were physically impossible to complete.
Mm.
So then there were penalty sanctions brought in, where if you didn't complete your work, you could go to jail or you could get your money taken from you. So it was a very corrupt system. Therefore, the contract didn't actually protect them, because within Fiji, that the Fijian colonial government there put in rules and regulations to forcefully, one, silence the Grumitias community in Fiji, but also keep them in place. So you kind of enter this world where you're trying to complete your work, but it's physically impossible, and then they're taking your money away, or they're fining you or imprisoning you. And so what happened is a lot of people coming to Fiji, there was a high rate of suicides happening at the time, and the colonial government couldn't quite understand why it was happening. They didn't want to analyse their own system and see how indentured labour had actually, one, uprooted these communities and formed a disconnection to their homelands. That's quite stressful for them as well, that the environment that they'd given the Grimatias, it wasn't actually a healthy environment at all. And so the suicide rates fall higher with the men than the women. So this understanding came about that because the gender ratios were so bad, it must be sexual jealousy, it must be around the woman. And so indentured labour ends up moving into a conversation completely focused, especially in Fiji, on the Grimatias woman. So it's like the whole femme fatale, and they build this identity around the Grimatias woman that is about her, that she is the one kind of torturing and plaguing the Indian men in Fiji, you know, and that she's sexually promiscuous. She doesn't want to abide by standard Indian traditions when she comes to Fiji. She wants to break boundaries, choose her partner. And so they saw all of that as causing the distress in the coolie lines for the Grimatias coming to Fiji. So they placed all the blame on indenture not working on the woman, and it was based around their sexuality or their sexual agency. But in reality, what ended up happening was that the Grimatias woman recognised that they were, because they weren't getting paid for their domestic or sexual labour that the empire forcefully put on them, and they didn't know that they were coming to indenture for that either. So you have stories that you can find in the archives where these women are demonised, but a lot of women took that power back into their hands. So you get prostitution comes about. But it's actually amazing how these women upheld it, because it was to look after themselves and recognising that they weren't getting paid for all of this labour. And then a thing came about because of the circumstances of indenture, and it was a very violent setting. There's a lot of violence in the coolie lines as well. So women made an active decision to choose their partners. So they're like, if you're going to treat me badly, well, actually, I'm going to go to someone else who's going to treat me nicely. And so that's actually amazing, looking at that colonial system and how they tried to position the woman. That's actually just a small gesture of fighting back. And then you get bigger gestures where the Grimatias woman recognised the oppression that was being actively not just committed against them, but everyone in their community. So the woman actively formed protests, strikes across Fiji. One of the biggest strikes is the 1920 sugarcane strikes that happened in Rewa and Suva and Nzuri. So the Grimatias woman, they planned that and they put that forward, that strike. And they were demanding to the Fijian colonial government at the time for better wages. And this is at a transition in Fiji where we know we're leaving indenture and we're moving to the next phase. So they were worried about what's going to happen to our community next. So they wanted better living conditions, better food prices, because there's a food shortage in Fiji at the time, and better wages. So they initiated a strike, and it was amazing. There was thousands of men that ceased work in sugar plantations across the country because a group of women started it. But what was, there's that flip side to it. The Fiji Times, so the colonial newspaper in Fiji, demonised these women. They called them ghouls and goblins. And they said that, you know, they are less than human, that the things that they are doing, you know, is disgusting. Like, how could you do this to the colonies? So again, using that kind of, these identities that they'd made for the woman as bad woman against them to demonise what they'd done, the good work that they'd done for their community. And this is why we don't see the Grimatias woman in history, because the colonial government made sure that they were that
they were written out of it.
Well, it's more that that to carry on that blame, they had to carry that punishment of being of carrying an identity of the bad woman throughout history. Because when they are mentioned, it's these things of like, you get little snippets of saying, like, your woman is a very bad woman. That's a very common rhetoric. And it became like if you read the if you go into the archives and you read the colonial transcripts, the word prostitute became synonymous with the Indian woman.
Wow.
They use it quite freely in the colonial archives for the Indian woman or the Gurmitias woman. When so you see what I'm kind of saying is that within the history, that's literally how they were viewed.
That was the portrayal.
The portrayal.
Very sort of negative portrayal.
Yeah, very negative portrayal. And then you get things like the women's gang, and I think this is one of the most amazing things to come out of the Gurmitias woman organising.
Yeah.
They would actively seek out sexual predators in the sugarcane plantations, and the woman would gang up. So you could yell out and ask for help, and they would come to you in the sugarcane field and come help you. I think that's a really amazing thing, that these women were trying to look after everyone else within the community too. Mm. And they also sought to look after the Gurmitias men too, and like uphold and look after the community.
Mm. That actually is a really good segue into the other area that I wanted to talk to you about and get your, get your opinion on. So I mean, the portrayal that you've mentioned, very negative, very sort of rigid gender roles, gender norms and stereotypes, that if you didn't fit within, you were seen as the troublemaker, the age-old rhetoric around women who stand up and fight back. You've also mentioned the 1920s sugarcane riots, protests that you mentioned.
Strikes,
strikes that were organized by women, which is fantastic. I'm interested in your opinion about whether those sorts of portrayals back then, acknowledging that it wasn't that long back in time, that far back in time, whether they have influenced some of the gender roles and norms that are that you still see. I mean, in you know, in every country, basically, you see some of those gender norms. And the research that I've done specifically in the gender-based violence space points to the fact that we're in communities or in societies where those norms and stereotypes are more rigid. You'd see the violence against women is actually higher. Do you have a view on how those portrayals back in the colonial period have maybe influenced how women are seen today in Fiji?
Indo-Fijian
women's more specifically?
No, definitely. You know, colonialism is an active thing. It's not something that's actually finished. Like, we're living in a process of neo-colonialism. I think there's something to be said for the Indo-Fijian community where... because our colonizers tried to take our histories away from us and write us out of history, because we live around the silence, like we haven't had the opportunity to deal with our colonial trauma properly and work through, you know, what our colonizers did to us. And especially, it's a very violent thing to forcefully take people from their homelands. And so during indenture, that was never dealt with either. So what happens after indenture is you see a high rate of mental health issues coming out too. So yes, it has contributed to the gender issues within Fiji and how Indo-Fijian women are portrayed. I think there's definitely a thing around the notion between what a good woman is and what a bad woman is. And I think women who have unconventional relationships in Fiji can be more demonized quite easily, or you know, what she's doing is bad, or and women who get divorces and things like that. I think that definitely plays into old colonial rhetorics. But obviously, like, I'm quite fortunate. I come from a family that's very matriarchal, and so I think it's important that we build up strong female images within the community so that we can kind of break these stereotypes and these norms. It's going to take a long time, because colonialism was something that was enacted on my community for a while and other communities experiencing colonization. There's also something to be said about that there was a double colonization happening, that the Gurmitias community experienced a colonization within India, which obviously affected the Indian woman, and then there was another layer to it coming to Fiji. So there's lots of things to unpack and work on.
I know that a lot of your work also touches on some of your feelings of perhaps alienation or isolation as someone of Indo-Fijian descent living here in Aotearoa. How important, or how has the concept of identity shaped you as a person and an artist?
I think so. Just to talk to the isolation part, I'll talk to just my individual experience. I can't talk for every Indo-Fijian.
Sure.
Yeah, but I think that there's, I definitely enacted Indian passing coming to a Western country because I saw that as a more cleaner identity, an easier identity to uphold, because it became so much more complicated explaining Indo-Fijianness to someone. And then I realized that that's actually really connected to, again, a colonial rhetoric of us, that the portrayal of Indo-Fijian was lesser than India because it's something less definable.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to realize that also, like, we make up less than 1 million people across the world, I believe. I might have that number a bit wrong. So our representation as a community, it hasn't really been there at all. So living around that silence was really hard understanding how I fit in. And I am, and like, to someone looking at me, they'll just see me as Indian. So it became a lot easier just to be like, just to agree with that and be like, yeah, I'm Indian, that's it. And so coming and acknowledging Indo-Fijian history is a sense of empowerment for me particularly, but it's also something to address with my own mental health issues as a female descendant of indentured labour, and realising that actually, like, I'm still dealing with the same thing, like, not the same situation as my ancestors, but those emotions that came out of living in a system like that, I'm still trying to unpack that within my body as a descendant. And so being able to assert myself through my work is, one, giving myself a voice, and in return giving my female ancestors a voice too. I think that's very important. But also it's my way of looking at this history and unpacking it and figuring out where I need to reintroduce those histories and those stories. I'm still young, so there's like a lot of work to be done, but it's more importantly about not letting those histories die. Like, because in the Western academic sense of history, that's where our female ancestors were left to die. It was in colonial archives. It was in written history textbooks. So it's about having, like, still letting them live and exist, but using different modes to express that. Looking at traditional craft as one of those ways of expressing our histories. And the reason why it's important to use craft is it's something that our women have engaged with for centuries.
Sure.
Yeah.
So did you grow up in New Zealand or in Fiji?
It was a bit of a mix. So I was born in Auckland, then I was brought back to Fiji, and then we moved again when I was, I think, around like 6 or 7.
Right. And where in India did your ancestors move from? So, where were they taken from?
So I know that we're of North Indian heritage because of the rituals and the type of Hinduism we engage with in Fiji. But I can't actually give any specifics. I've talked to my family about it, and again, coming back to the notion of silence, memories have faded, and because colonial shame has been upheld for so long in the community, some people have lost the stories.
Yeah.
And it's really hard, like, you don't want to put that kind of pressure on your elders because it kind of feeds into that shame again as well.
Yeah.
But I've talked with my family about it, and we know snippets of names, but the thing is, like,
you can't pinpoint where exactly you're from.
Yeah, some people are very fortunate to have that information, but yeah. I'm not. And I was upset about that to begin with, but actually that's fine. That's just a part of the history of being Indo-Fijian. And but we do know that we probably come from Bihar or Uttar Pradesh, from those areas. Yeah.
Cool. Gosh, there's so much more that I want to talk to you about, because I think the work that you've done, sort of weaving creativity and craft with really politics, activism, and looking at that aspect of economic empowerment for women through craft as well,
yeah.
I think it's just such a fascinating space to be in. But we are coming to the end of time, unfortunately, so I just wanted to ask you if there were any final comments or points that you wanted to make. What are you trying to achieve with your work? What would success look like for you? in a minute?
Oh, in a minute. I don't think I'm really looking for success. Like, one, I just want to work for my community and understand how better I can tell Indo-Fijian histories. I think that's probably the biggest thing for me, is that this work is leading into more community-based work in the future and eventually moving back to Fiji. That's
amazing.
My ultimate goal. Yeah.
Okay, right. Well, it's been lovely to chat with you, Kashil. Thank you so much for the work that you do and the passion with which you do it.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Not at all. Have a lovely break to all our listeners as well. Have a wonderful break. And see you all in 2019.
Get together with your local MP next week at 9:05 a.m. or listen online anytime on planetaudio.org.nz/redalertradio.